Succession number 27315, reel one.
Testing.
Right. Michael Maltin, reel one. Can you tell me, first of all, where you were born?
I was born in Chippenham, Wiltshire, in 1920, May 1920.
And what did your father do?
He was a parson. I come from a sort of... He's a parson, and my brother is a parson. I'm the heathen in the family, but perhaps you better scrub that bit out.
And where did you go to school?
I went to several schools, owing to the fact that my father was moving around. I was born in Chippenham. Then he moved to Bristol, and I went to a primary school in Bristol. Then I sort of outgrew that and moved on to somewhere else. Then I went to a school in Cotton, and then I went to Bristol Grammar School. And there I got a singing scholarship to Bristol Cathedral, so I was a choral scholar there. I used to wear ruff, very pretty I was. And then it sort of progressed from there through several bits of schools because my father was moving. And from his point of view, the last thing of all was he was Vicar of Stroud, where we are now, which is why I'm in this area, because I knew everybody in this area. And he's dead now, of course, but it caused a lot of moving around.
What age did you leave school?
19, I think. I was progressively nearly getting my trick. I was credit in science, credit in physics, credit in maths, failed French, and you had to do the lot in those days, so... But it was 19, and that was the time when I applied to join the RAF.
Why the RAF?
Well, the idea was that I would fly. I would like to fly. And of course, it was an Imperial Airways in those days. And it was suggested to me that if I joined the RAF, they'd teach me to fly for nothing, which would be ideal. And after 4 years, I would be given... a nice bonus of £500, which would be worth having, and I could then apply to Imperial Airways to join their gang. Unfortunately, I will say that I was accepted by the RAF, did all the usual interviews in all the usual places.
Where were you interviewed?
Ah, oh dear. There's a book by a Spitfire pilot called First Light or something, and I'm practically following his career. So if you really want to know, look up where he went. It was somewhere in... Name's gone.
Did they give you tests? Aptitude tests?
Oh, yes. A lot of aptitude tests. In fact, it was probably interesting. They were giving us all these... trying to keep a spot of light in the same place. And they said, doesn't matter how well you do, but we're using these tests to assess pilots which are coming afterwards on your efforts at being a pilot. So we're guinea pigs, really.
And did you do well at all those tests, or were some of them...
I'll never know. Right. But they accepted me, so...
That was okay.
That was it, and then I was waiting at home... for this, and then the war opened, which started up, and 2 days later I got papers saying it was all in abeyance, and please will I report to Uxbridge, which I did.
And you went to Uxbridge. Where from? Was from this, from Bristol, or...?
Not quite sure now.
Never mind.
A box, right. Wiltshire. Not this box, Wiltshire, yeah. Near Chippenham.
So you went off on the train...
Yes.
Yeah. What was it like arriving at Uxbridge? What did you see? What sort of a place was it?
Well, it's a long time ago. It seemed quite vast to me. Lots of people stomping up and down. But I must say, they were very good to us. They didn't issue us with boots because we were going to be flying aeroplanes. So we were the privileged ones wearing shoes.
Right. So what was the reception like? I mean, they got, I imagine, quite a lot of you turning up on that day. How did they sort you out and get you equipped?
We were sort of in batches, and you went here for a medical and there for an injection or two or three, and somewhere else for a hat, and you were carting kit around the place.
And what about the other chaps who were joining the same time? What sort of people were they? Were they from all over the place?
Oh, more or less the same sort of motley, really. A mixed lot, but near enough the same.
Mostly your age?
Oh, yes. We were all 18, 19, 20 years, that sort of thing.
And how did your training begin? What did they actually do with you first?
Well, if you look at the records, the winter of 1939 was absolutely bitter, and they couldn't do anything, and all the airfields were closed down, and there wasn't really a war on anyway. So I finished up having spent about 2 months at some training place learning about a Lewis gun. It was put on aerodrome defence on a gas-operated something else. Anyway, I was there for a couple of months and then eventually went to a flying training school.
Right. And where was that? Where was the flying
school? Can't remember. If you switch it off, I'll look it up.
Yeah, not to worry, yeah. So what was that like? I mean, now you were actually starting to do what you wanted to do. So how did they begin training you?
Oh, it's all very straightforward. The flying then was, I should imagine, fairly hasty, because we were going solo in sort of 8 hours, or 6 to 8 hours.
And what planes were you learning?
Magisters, low-wing monoplane Magisters, which then went on to Masters, where I was at Sealand. And, of course, Masters was the jumping off ground for the Spitfire, which I first flew at Harden.
So how easy was it to learn to fly in those planes?
Well, it's not difficult to fly an aeroplane, is it, really?
You tell me. Sounds difficult to me.
No, I didn't find it particularly difficult, no.
Were most people able to cope with it?
Oh, I think so, yes, yes.
And what was it like going solo for the first time?
In what? For the first time?
Yes.
Well, it just sort of happened, you know. They walk off and say, right, it's all yours, do a circuit and land and report to Hut B or whatever. And you get up there and think, well, I'm up now, I've got to get it down. And I've had that feeling every aeroplane I've flown, including the Comet and the lots, you know. But straightforward.
What was the sense? Did you have any sense of what you'd be doing? I mean, did you know whether you'd be doing fighters or bombers or...?
I knew it would be fighter command, I think. Well, that's what they were looking out for at the time. Bomber command was sort of... I don't know the background of all this, but I should imagine that the main requirement was for fighter pilots at that time, 1939, 1940.
What did you hear about what was going on, in France?
Not a lot. There wasn't a lot in the papers. You could read bits of this and bits of that and losses, but even in those days we thought, well, pinch of salt. We were beating them so well, it's a wonder we hadn't won the war immediately, of course, was not necessarily true.
So quite optimistic, really?
Oh, optimistic, yes.
Mm-hmm. Any idea that it would... I mean, did you have much of an idea of what the German Air Force was like and how they might, come over Britain?
No, not really. I knew there was something coming up. Mm-hmm. In fact, by the time I got to... leaving Magisters and getting on for all the groundwork for the Spitfire, most of the main stuff was, the writing was on the wall for the Germans, I think.
Right. So from Sealand, you then went to where?
I went to St. Evel in Cornwall.
Yeah.
234 Squadron, which I believe, well, it was an operational squadron.
Yeah. And you went on to Spitfires there, did you?
Oh, yes, it was Spitfires all the way from then. After Harden, did I go back to, I think it was Sealand.
Went to Harden after
Sealand. Yeah, to Sealand, to Spitfires, and then straight to the operational squadron.
So what was it like joining a squadron? Because it's...
Well, same lot of fellows, really. Though, you felt reasonably at home. You were learning all the time. The training was so hurried that, in fact, I had never flown a Spitfire at night till I was on an operational call off St. Devil, coming in over the cliffs and using car headlights to light up the... light up the runway, so it was all a bit sort of jolly hockey sticks, really.
So you were thrown in at the deep end, but it sounds as though you quite enjoyed that.
Well, yes. They had to have pilots, and it was, the quick of the dead, really, and there weren't many accidents. There were one or two who wouldn't make it, but... Spitfire's a beautiful airplane to fly.
And they were relatively new then, were they?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
This was the first batch almost. Mark II, I think it was. I'm not quite sure.
What was their main virtue? Was there something you could pick on them?
Most beautiful airplane to land, except that you couldn't see where you were going. You had to land off a turn all the time because of that great big nose, but... apart from that, it handled beautifully. You didn't fly it. You thought about what you wanted to do.
And it did it for
you. It did it for you.
So what about practice firing?
The squadron we used to have exercises, formation flying and all the rest of it, and they'd chase you out over the Atlantic looking for a JU-88 or something that had been reported, but you'd never see it and you'd never catch it anyway. These sort of things. And for firing, we used to have a sort of practice range. From St. Devil I went to Warmall because, we were replacing losses that were going on in Biggin Hill and all the rest of it. And they moved the squadron up to Warmall and we did an enormous number of practices on Chesil Bank. Do you know it? Used to come down and shoot at the stones. I broke my windscreen during that because the stones came up and I flew through it. But that was interspersed with operational scrambles and various things.
So on an operational scramble, you'd be going up to look for something which had been spotted, is that right?
Well, you didn't know what you were doing until you got airborne, mostly, because... excuse me. They would call, they'd ring the old bell and everybody would dash out to the aeroplane. You didn't know what you were doing until you got airborne. On one occasion, I only mention this because somebody else might remember it from Warmall, we were stood down for the afternoon and we were all at the local cinema. And they put up, will 234 Squadron report to base? And within, I can't tell you how many minutes, but we had 14 of a squadron of 12 airborne. So that was the sort of thing. There was no briefing, you're going to do this or going to do that. You got airborne, and whoever was leading formation was advised by radio. There wasn't much in the way of radio silence in those days.
Mm. So did you get any training or practice for dogfights and that sort of thing?
No. Not really. You just stuck in with whatever the leader was doing and formated. Unless you were tail end Charlie, in which case you were weaving about. You must have interviewed a lot of people and know all about this.
Yeah. Not really, no. And it's nice to hear it from you because you were there. Because it's so much more vivid than the books and so on. So, had you any idea... that you'd be going, you must have gone into battle, as it were, fairly quickly.
Yes, I think it really started really started at Warmall. There wasn't a lot doing at St Eval, but Warmall, yes, we were forever big scrambled and climbing up to 20,000 feet or more. And but by this time, I think most of them were very hesitant about coming over here, and we used to get bombers coming in mostly then. They bombed Warmall when I was on the ground and made a mess of everything.
And did you have anti-aircraft batteries?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, rather.
How effective were they?
Very effective. They were quite... we could see what was going on. You see black puffs coming up in all directions. And mainly the anti-aircraft that I was running into was the other side of the channel, which was much later on, because from Warmall I went to a satellite of Tangmere, which was West Hampnett.
Was that 616?
That was 616. Name-dropping Douglas Bader.
Yes, yeah.
I was in his squadron.
Were you? What sort of a chap was he?
Miserable. You wanted to avoid him mostly because he tended to shout. I nearly shot him down once. Well, only by accident. No, he's... He was fine. He was a fantastic pilot. He really was. You could always tell him in the air, because he would approach the airfield and you think, that's not a Spitfire. But it was. It was upside down. And he'd put his wheels up and roll over as he went over the hedge. And I've never seen him come in any other way. He was absolutely an incredible pilot with his no feet. But you wouldn't want to get on the wrong side of him. But you had to take your hat off to him for his ability. Tremendous man. Yes, I was flying with him sort of, you know, out here on one thing. This is going much later on, because by this time you didn't get the 109s and the bombers coming into London. They'd more or less disappeared, and we were on what we used to call offensive sweeps, which was going out over the channel into France looking for trouble. And that was exciting.
So tell me about one of those trips.
Well, it's difficult to say, really. You knew what was going to happen then. You weren't scrambled. It was all organised, and you meet up with a couple of other squadrons, climb up to about, 12, 15,000 feet, head out over the channel. And, as I say, looking for trouble or looking for trains or something like that. And you could hear on the radio what was going on, because the controllers were magnificent. And then somebody would spot something. You know, this business of out of the sun is really true, because if they're sitting up there, you cannot see them. And... anyway, everybody would then mix in, and that got quite exciting. You generally pick on somebody, or somebody would pick on you, mostly that way round, and that's where the Spitfire came in, because I owe my life to that thing. I shouldn't really be telling you this, should I? But I did get some wretched ME-109 on my tail. So I thought, right, blow this for a lark. Went into a very hard turn, and he did the same. We were literally going round like this. And I thought, if I tighten up, he'll spin out, which he did. And he went down in the cloud, and I never saw him again. But that's a Spitfire for you.
Do you remember your first kill, if that's the right
thing? No, I've never shot anybody down. I've had my hood shot off. Mostly I was number two to somebody who was doing most of the damage. But I tell you one peculiar thing, and I expect other people have mentioned this to you, that when all this stopped, you know, you were up in the air, you were on your own. There was nobody else in sight anywhere. They'd all disappeared, and the only thing to do then was to go like a bat out of hell straight down to to France, fly as low as you could till you got to the Channel, and get right down till the shadow of your aeroplane, because you know the sun being sort of westish, you could see the shadow, and you get right down till you were almost sitting on it so that they couldn't get behind you, and then just not pull up till you got to the coast. And that happened to practically everybody, I think, going back across the Channel.
And did you have any, I mean, what sort of things were you looking out for over in France? I mean, were you looking for things to shoot up or...?
Well, on some of them, particularly Baader's lot, we were looking for enemy aircraft, usually, because they were, you know, more or less forced to scramble when they had a horde of Spitz coming over, you see. So, and then you'd mix it. But I think by this time, you see the writing on the wall. And,
so you had air superiority?
At that time, yes, very much so.
Yeah. Is this in the summer of 1940? Or
no, this isn't much later than this. I'm talking about 41,
right.
Getting on for the end of 41, 42.
So you went operational about when? Because you joined in 39,
didn't you? Can you switch it off a second?
Yes,
I'll tell you.
You were just saying that in April 41 you were doing convoy patrols in the Channel. Tell me about that.
Well, there was a lot of shipping going on, obviously, the stuff coming in, mostly going along the Channel with carrying balloons, and we were making sure they weren't too shot up with these bombers coming over. So we used to do that. We used to do high-cover escorts for Blenheims and things going to ports like Caen and round about that side, just into France. And you were talking about anti-aircraft fire. The flak was unbelievable coming out of France, and these poor Blenheim pilots, I don't know how they managed, they were dead steady all the way in. And we were stuck up at 10, 15,000 feet, thinking, I'm glad I'm in a Spitfire. It was quite hazardous.
Yeah. And I mean, you must have been, you know, having losses in your squadron. How was that dealt with?
Just used to write the names in the logbook. You know, Sergeant somebody lost or whatever. That was the trouble. We were continually moved on, like from Warmall to Tangmere to West Hampnett to what's Biggin Hill satellite? Kenley. That's my aeroplane there.
Oh, yeah.
At Kenley with my two ground crew on it.
Yeah.
But there was so much going on and so many movements. I actually did a stint at Hawkinge in Kent on Spitfires. And after about 100 ops, they thought they had enough out of me, so I got married.
Oh.
Gave me a day off. And I became an instructor.
That's all it was, too, a day off.
A weekend, yes.
Yeah. And you became an instructor?
And became an instructor.
Right.
And I went up to Scotland, and that was the first time I ever flown Tiger Moth.
Right, okay.
That was frightening.
Yeah. We'll just say with this time at the moment, how much of a strain was it doing all these constant operations?
I can't answer that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it was. All my life I've been flying aeroplanes and concentrating on what I'm doing at the time, and that's your job. And you don't sort of think before you go, golly, I'm going to take 100 passengers to Delhi today or something. You just, it's a job to do and you do it. And it's the same during the war. I think you used to rush out to the airplane and think, we've got some good ground crew here. I know it'll start. And you get in it and you'd rather be up in the air if it was a bombing raid coming in than being on the ground. So... No, I don't think it was a strain, really.
So you didn't think I might not come back?
I didn't think I'd see another Christmas, but everybody thought that. You thought, well, it's good while it lasts, and you weren't going to see Christmas. I was very surprised when it came round. I was still in one piece.
Yeah. So did you get very tired? I mean, imagine...
Yes. Yeah, very. You'd fall asleep at the drop of a hat.
And what about in your spare time? I mean, was that mostly spent in the mess, or...?
Mostly wrapping string round vintage Bentley steering wheels. I don't know where they came from, but there was always a Bentley on the airfield, and somebody was trying to improve it or do something with it.
So
but there wasn't much in the way of leave, was there? No. Oh, you didn't know me then. Yeah. Well, you did know me, but...
So it was more or less a sort of continuous job, if I can
put it that. It was a more or less continuous job, yeah. Yes.
I mean, was it any different days of the week? I mean, Sundays or...
I don't think we knew what day of the week it was in those days.
Yeah. Did anybody drop out because of the sort of...
There was a thing called LMF, which you know about, do you? Lack of moral fibre, they used to say. People who went all blah, 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 you know, and decided it was all too much. But very rarely.
Yeah.
You didn't do that sort of thing.
And what did you think of people that happened to?
Well, you just thought, hard luck, that's unfortunate for them. Mm. Must be awful, you know.
Because they went off and...
Oh, they were put to, I don't know, working the mines, probably. No, I don't know.
Yeah, right.
But they were just taken out, which seems such a pity, really, after all that training.
Yes, yeah. So you became an instructor after Hawkinge, was it?
I became an instructor, back in Kenley then, I think. I can't remember. Without going through the logbook, I can't really say. But I know I'd done my last operational flight. I think they used to let you do 100 and then pack you off.
And so you became an instructor and you went to Scotland.
I went up to Scotland. The training, Dalcross.
Dalcross.
Which is now a huge ski resort, I believe.
Right.
And then I came back and went to, up the road,
South Cerny,
near Cirencester.
So tell me about Dalcross then. What did they actually, how did they train you to be an instructor?
Well, the aeroplane was new, of course. It was called a Tutor, which was rather like an overgrown tiger moth. We had both there. But it wasn't so much handling the aeroplane as how to teach other people to do it. As has been said so many times in my career, if you'd like to say, that you're not paid to fly aeroplanes. You're supposed to know how to fly aeroplanes, you know, and... Even in BOAC they said that too. It's knowing all the other things around it and all the emergencies about the aeroplanes and the fuel and the fire and all the various gubbinses, and then how to handle the people who are coming along. And that didn't last more than about a fortnight, and I was back instructing at South Cerny on Oxfords, twin-engined Oxfords.
So you were getting... Were these... people newly joined the Air Force, or...?
A lot of the people in Oxford were coming over from Canada or South Africa, the Arnold Scheme, I think it was called. And they could fly all right, but they couldn't navigate. In Canada, all the hedges and... roads all run north, south, east and west, you know, so they take off from Oxford and would be totally lost. So we spent a lot of time not only teaching them to fly in England, but to get the navigation up to scratch, which is a great thing. I didn't mention navigation with Spitfires, did I? I don't think we ever carried maps, or if we did, they were stuffed down your flying boot. And you used to do everything with a sort of gummy pencil on the back of your hand as to where you were. And you couldn't cross the south coast of England and not recognise where you were from Dover to Land's End, you knew it. I mean, Weymouth you can see, the Isle of Wight you can see. You knew everywhere. As you get in your car and you think, oh, I've got to go to Bristol, you know, you knew it. But floating around in an aeroplane when you haven't got a great big coastline like that used to crease these fellows. They used to get lost in all directions.
Right, I'll stop you there. Michael Maltin, end of reel one.
Poor Christine, they sent her these things, particularly the newspaper.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Okay. Yes, you were saying, sorry.
Right. Michael Maltin, reel two. So these people who'd come over from South Africa and Canada, these were volunteers, were they, or were they from their own air forces?
I can't say. Never went into it. They were a batch of pilots which would come along, and you'd be given about three or four of them. And you'd take them up in the aeroplane, and when you felt time was right, you'd send them one at a time, send them solo. And after a bit, I was in charge of the night flying at Bybury, which is surprising considering my history. And we used to send them up at night on a flare path there.
Yeah. Tell me about your history of night flying then.
I'll tell you about somebody else's. Shall I tell that story? We had one poor fellow. They said, an Oxford, you've never seen an Oxford, have you? It's sort of a great big empty thing, especially these. They've not fitted with anything. And they said, don't. When you get so low, don't look over his shoulder. It looks like a coffin. And this fellow was just about off in his solo, and we had a tyre checker. And one of the tyres was a bit flat, so this fellow opens the door and gets in. This fellow's lined up at the rim dryer, he just takes off, and he gets a tap on the shoulder. He'd taken off the tyre, man. How he got round the circuit, I don't know. Anyway, it was all very exciting in those days. And all following that, I did a course on blind landings, and we were instructing on I can't remember the name of the stuff now, I must have paid a lot of attention, at Oxford.
Right, and this was something new, was it, blind landings?
Oh, very much, yes. This it was a sort of a beam where you could hear dots to the left and dashes to the right, and you... Of course, a dot and a dash, when merged, becomes a steady note, and you could come all the way down to the runway.
So what sort of equipment did you have in the plane for that?
Oh, a couple of radio receivers, not a lot, and some receivers which would tell you that you were sort of coming over a beacon 2 miles away, and you ought to be at 600 feet, and then you come to another one and drop it down, and you fly level till you got to that. And you could actually land totally blind. I've done this in thick fog, at South Cerny. You come in, cross the last one, can't see a thing, ease the stick back, cut the power, and you're on the grass. Fantastic.
And that was something very new. So
that was very new, yes. Probably, yes.
Yeah. And was that available at many airfields? Or?
Well, it became available very quickly, of course, but at that time it was very new.
Yeah.
Very new.
Yeah. So, as an instructor, did you feel left out at all, you know, that you weren't operational or...?
No, it was very nice. Read about all these other poor fellows working their shoes off. Yeah. No, it was quite hard work, actually, but it was fairly straightforward. The worry is that you're not doing it yourself. I don't know what sort of a passenger you are in a car, but to send somebody solo is quite a strain on you, you know, because you think, did I overlook anything? Is he as good as I hoped he might be? And it wasn't easy, but there we are.
What about the other instructors? Were they all sort of time-served men, as it were, like yourself? Or?
A lot of them, a few of them, had operational experience, but I can't really remember, not a great deal, I think, really.
Because it would strike me that having operational experience would be a very good thing.
Well,
to make you an efficient instructor.
I don't know, really. It meant you could fly an aeroplane.
And also you knew what it was like to be in combat, really, which is...
I don't think that ever came into it. I don't think we ever discussed that.
Right.
just made sure that what they were doing properly then, you know. Yeah. And I did that for about 3.5 years.
Which takes us to where then?
Which takes us to 1944, mm-hmm. and they decided I'd had enough of the easy life, mm-hmm. and I was posted to Bomber Command.
Right.
And initially, all training was on Halifax, just like my machine gun. You didn't know what you didn't finish up flying them, but I went on a Lancaster squadron. Poor Christine. She,